Okay, so let me just give a little bit of a notice about the sources here. A lot of the talk is taken from a shiur given by Rabbi Jeremy Weider. Has anybody here ever heard of Rabbi Jeremy Weider? Besides for y'all?
Did you say Weider?
Weider, yes. Rabbi Jeremy Weider is a Rosh Hashiva NYU. He's extremely intelligent person. I believe he won Chidon HaTanach, I think. I'm pretty sure. And he just really, really, really very, very smart guy. And he gave a controversial shiur basically on this topic as part of YU's Kol Yom Rishon program. He gave it more than once, I think, but this is the one that's recorded. And he covers here the subject basically of the first 11 chapters of Bereishit and perhaps more. So that's what we're kind of discussing tonight, the historicity of, you know, let's go with Sefer Bereishit, just to make things interesting and as far-reaching as possible. Say again? Well, let's see. So, to start, we'll start with the challenge. Has anybody here heard of Gilgamesh? Yes? Okay, Gilgamesh is basically, it's kind of like the Odyssey, that's what I compare it to. It's like an old, long tale with a lot of different parts to it. People think that Gilgamesh is the one who was, inside of that epic, right, there's one story which is a flood story, where there's a person who survives a big flood in a boat, and then he sends away birds and everything, and the gods try to destroy him, and he survives the flood. People think that's Gilgamesh. It's not. The whole book is called the Gilgamesh Epic, or I don't think that's the technical name for it, but that's what people call it.
Gilgamesh was a king of the Sumerian city,
yeah,
of Uruk.
Right. So, and I don't think these stories are necessarily all true, the ones in the book. It's, like I said, it's kind of like the Odyssey.
Whatever they call it.
I have no idea how much of it is historical, how much of it is not. But one part of it is the story of Utnapishtim. That's the guy, that's our Noach. Utnapishtim is the one who survives the flood. So I have an entry here from Wikipedia just to make things simple. I kind of was looking at different websites. This is the best that I could see. Gilgamesh's historical reign of Lita been approximately 2700 BCE, shortly before the earliest known written story. So 2700 BCE, that's a long time ago. Right, we're in 5, 7, 7. Let's make it simple. We're in 2018. 2018 plus 2700. That's pretty much the whole timeline, right? So the discovery of artifacts associated with Aga, and I'm not going to pretend to know how to pronounce that.
What? That's a timeline since the flood.
Before the flood.
Because that's 4,700 years.
Right.
We're 57.
The flood was 1050 something. 1050, I think. I don't know. 1056, I think. Yeah. If I remember correctly. But I don't necessarily remember correctly.
So that's basically, so 2700 years is at the flood.
Right. But these stories are from before. So he says, the earliest Sumerian Gilgamesh poems date from as early as the 3rd dynasty of Ur, which is 2100 BCE. Meaning, they date the cuneiform tablets that they found, where it's written on, those are dated to 2100. But the story is supposed to have happened in 2700, right? So it's 600 years later. One of these poems mentions Gilgamesh's journey to meet the flood hero, right? The flood hero is Utnapishtim, not Gilgamesh, as well as a short version of the flood story. The earliest Akkadian versions of the unified epic are dated to circa 2000-1500. Due to the fragmentary nature of these old Babylonian versions, it's unclear whether they included an expanded account of the flood myth, although one fragment definitely includes the story of Gilgamesh's journey to meet him. The standard Akkadian version included a long version of the story and was edited by sometime between 1300 and 1000 BC. The short version over here is that there is this story that they've dated going way back. Inside the story, in many versions of the story, it includes a flood story. From what I was reading, the flood story actually is much later. The pieces of the flood story that they put into the story are actually from much later than most of these early stories, which will, you know, will come in handy later. But the challenge over here becomes, if we've got these stories, which some of them predate the flood story from our Chumash, so then what does that mean for the Noach story? And we'll... that you understand the challenge. In other words, one person will come along and say that we cribbed our story from that older story. And I want to evaluate the merits of that, what it would imply, whether it's true, whether it's not true. And what does it mean for us as Jews, and what should we believe? Because this is something that when you grow out of high school, this is something that you encounter, right? I remember talking about this at work with one of my colleagues who, you know, he had watched a few videos on YouTube about this. He was, you know, he's a Chiloni guy, and he wanted to talk to me about it, so we talked about it a little bit. If I didn't know anything, then it probably would very much disturb me. He was actually telling me, this friend of mine, who I worked with, his brother is a Haredi guy living in Emmanuel. He's a Chabad rabbi there. And his son are all Haredim. And when he comes over, right, my friend, when he comes over, so he kind of starts up with the whole family. And with his brother, he gets along. But he, you know, I don't think his brother appreciates it when he kind of puts ideas in these kids' heads. And this is one of them. He actually said to them, you know that there's this story about Gilgamesh, and the sons didn't believe him at first. And then they asked the father, and the father said, no, yeah, that's actually true, but it doesn't bother us because of X and Y. So what is X and Y? So before we get there, though, let's talk about how we should approach the Torah b'chlal and Sefer Bereishit b'frat, because that's where history kind of breaks down. Okay. So first, I mean that let's say from Parashat Shemot, let's say from Sefer Shemot and on, I'll put it the way that Rabbi Weider put it. No, you know what? I'm not going to do that yet. We're going to first read this part. We're going to first read the next part. The next part is where we suggest the possibility that there are some parts of the Torah that we'll read that aren't what we would call historical. In other words, that the events that they described did not happen the way that they described them. Is that possible? So let's start. So the first place we'll look at is Rav Sadia Gaon. And these are going to be first, they're going to be general, and then they're going to get specific. So Rav Sadia Gaon lived in the 10th century, a precursor to the Rambam, really in...
Spain?
No. Bavel. Before that. And he wrote a book called Sefer Emunah of V'Deot, and it's actually quite hard to read, so it's nice to have an English translation. And he says, and so I declare, he's describing how we should analyze the Torah. I declare, first of all, that it is a well-known fact that every statement found in the Bible is to be understood in its literal sense, except for those that cannot be so construed, for one of the following four reasons. Okay, so the Sadia Gaon is giving us four situations that we should be able to apply where you must go away from the literal meaning of the words in the Torah. And what are they?
Meanings, what we call pshat.
So I don't want to say pshat, and we'll see why. Literal meaning, take it for what it's worth, right? Literal meaning.
Like Yad Hashem, it actually happened?
That's one of, yeah. Well, let's see his examples, because some of his examples are a little bit fuzzier than others. So I think your guys are going to kind of like not like the first example. So watch this. It may, for example, be rejected by the observation of the senses. So if you find something in the Torah that is contradicted by what you see with your eyes, then that means that what is being described by the Torah must be in some way metaphorical. It can't be literal. So for example, you're not going to like this example. Such as the statement, and the man called his wife's name Eve because she was the mother of all living. Whereas we see that the ox and the lion are not the offspring of womankind. In other words, when the Torah says, Kihi eim kol chai, it doesn't literally mean she is the mother of all chai. Now, I didn't like this example because like nobody would have ever thought that Chava was the mother of cows. Like nobody, obviously, it means something metaphorical. You don't even need Rav Sadia Gaon to... And in that sense, what I mean over here, why I don't like literal versus pshat, is because nobody would have ever suggested that this wasn't pshat. Like, nobody would ever say that pshat is that Chava gave birth to wolves. Nobody ever say that. But if you were reading it literally, then you might have said that.
If you read it literally because she was birthed after animals. So how could you literally read... She's the mother of that which came before.
Right.
It's also a matter of translation. Kol Chai could mean all human life. It doesn't necessarily have to mean
all
life.
Right, so that's exactly what he's saying. He's saying here, it's a pretty good example actually, hence we must conclude that the implication of the statement embraces human descendants only. So he goes differently actually. Dad, you're right. This is exactly what he's saying. He's saying when it says Em Kol Chai, it means humans. She's the mother of all humans. Which, if I was reading it literally, I might not have read that way, but he's saying you have to read it that way. Example number one. Hence, we must conclude, okay, or else the literal sense may be neglected by reason. Okay, so this is not by empirical evidence, but by a priori cognitive evidence. So what's an example of that? For the Lord thy God is a devouring fire, a jealous God. Now, fire is something created and defective, for it is subject to extinction. Hence, it is logically inadmissible that God resemble it. Now, this is a medieval argument about defective and not defective. It doesn't resonate so much with us because we don't speak in these terms. I would have said like this. Look, God is being described by the Torah as a fire. Now, do I know for a fact empirically that God is not a fire? Do I? Empirically speaking. No. Because I've never seen God, so I can't know whether he is a fire or he's not a fire. But do I know philosophically that he can't be a fire? Yes, our conceptions of God don't allow for him to be a fire, because fire is, well, you know what, to use his words, it's defective, it's destructive. It wouldn't work logically for him to be a fire, and therefore when the Torah says that God is a fire, it must mean he's like a fire in some way.
It's a metaphorical statement.
Right, it's metaphorical.
No one's ever seen God.
No. Now.
Brains don't allow us to imagine anything other than him being human-like.
We have trouble envisioning God in any way.
That's my point.
But we could say, but we are sure that he is not actually a fire. We must therefore impute to the statement the meaning that God's punishment is like a consuming fire. In other words, in some way God is like a fire, but not that he is a fire. In accordance with the remark made elsewhere, for all the earth shall be divided with the fire of my jealousy. Good, so you can even find another pasuk that implies that. That's number two. Number three, the literal meaning of a biblical statement may be rendered impossible by an explicit text of a contradictory nature, in which case it would become necessary the first statement in a non-literal sense. So if you have two psukim in the Torah that contradict each other, one of them must be reinterpreted in a non-literal sense. Okay? So when Torah contradicts itself, you have to explain it otherwise.
So why did he necessarily say the first statement?
I don't know. I don't know if that's just a translation issue. I don't either think that it has to be the first statement. One of them has to be. I think probably if it was written in Hebrew, it's probably ha-echad, which probably just means one of them. Finally, fourth one, any biblical statement to the meaning of which rabbinic tradition has attached a certain reservation is to be interpreted by us in keeping with this authentic tradition. So basically saying, if the rabbis say, Mipi Kabbalah, that the pasuk means one thing, then it must mean that. What's an example of that? It's a tricky example. What? Ben Sorer Mare, in what sense?
In the sense that it's reinterpreted to have preconditions applied to it that make it all.
Right, so I thought that's what you meant. But that's not interpreting the words differently. That's just adding on extra clauses. I think Ayin Tachanayin is a great example. That's a pretty good example. Yeah, yeah, that's a very good example. Also, perhaps, this is somewhat of a machlokas, but Lifnei Iver Lo Titen Michshol. Right? If I place a rock in front of a blind person and he trips over it, have I violated Lifnei Iver Lo Titen Michshol?
Yeah.
So many, many Mepharshim say, no, you're a jerk. You violated, you know, V'aftal Re'echa Kamocha, but you haven't violated Lifnei Iver Titen Michshol, because that's not what the words mean, Al Pi Pshat, that's not what they mean. Just like when I say God is a fire, I don't mean God is a fire. I also don't mean Lifnei Iver, I don't mean don't put a stumbling block in front of a blind person. I mean don't mislead people. That's what it means. So those are the four conditions under which we have the right and perhaps even the obligation to reinterpret the Torah in a non-literal sense.
Does Rav Sadia go and apply that throughout the
conflict? Yes.
With the burning bush, for instance, does he apply criteria number two and say that that wasn't literally a burning bush?
Why would he have to?
Because we know from our rational minds that a bush, if it's consumed by fire, will be burnt. It won't stay in a full state, which is what
But
that would contradict his point number two.
But if it was a miracle, then why would that be a problem?
But isn't he coming to the? I mean, how do you work miracles?
I don't think he's
criteria number two.
Just, I think if the Torah were to describe, for example, if the Torah describes the sun revolving around the earth, right? And we know that not to be true. So then that's what we have to do. The Torah describes the four corners of the earth, which it does all the time, right? But the earth is round. So we have to say that's not what that means. It means that everywhere. Four corners of the earth means everywhere. It doesn't mean that the earth has four corners. But I don't see, we're going to see a little bit of this later, but I don't see why when the Torah describes a miracle, that has to be non-literal. I mean, would you extend that to when Moshe Rabbeinu's staff turns into a snake, that should be a metaphor? Because Paro was impressed.
Then there'd be no such thing as a miracle then.
Right.
That's why I'm asking. I'm saying, how does Rav Sadia deal with miracles?
I don't think he has a problem with miracles. I don't think so.
Or else the literal sense may be neglected by reason.
That's logic. That's not.
Where's the reason? What's the problem with reason here?
To suggest that a bush can be consumed by fire and not be burnt.
That's not logic. Reasonable isn't logical.
I can imagine it happening. I can imagine it happening. So it's not a problem of reason. It might be a problem of empiricity in actuality we say it doesn't happen. But again, then you have the miracle exit.
Seems to me that none of these four reasons we just read can be applied to the story of Noah. The fact that we have a prior story of Gilgamesh, which some might say seems to belie the story of Noah. None of these reasons apply to that.
Why not? If you were to say that, for example, if we had empirical evidence that the Gilgamesh story happened, and we felt strongly enough that if it happened, then probably the Noah story didn't happen as the Torah describes it, then you would have license. If you were compelled that way, if you felt, I am not comfortable with the story that the Torah tells us, it cannot have happened the way it did, then it seems that Rav Sadia Gaon has given you license to do that.
Why does the Gilgamesh story existence mean that the Noah story didn't happen?
I'm not saying it has to do that, but for some people, there's a very, very old story called the Gilgamesh Epic, which includes in it a flood story, a worldwide flood, in which a character called Utnapishtim survives. It has a lot of similarities to the story of Noah. It's very old. Well, no, way before. Near Eastern Sumeria. The part of the epic which is the flood story, it's not clear that it was actually originally part of the original tablets that were found, or whether that was actually found later and then just kind of meshed in together. But let's, be conservative about that and say it was all in there. So if you felt it can't be that it happened twice, right? And the likelihood is that the Noach story is the one that's the repeat, so then it seems like Rav Sadia Gaon would be able to say, if you were convinced by that, so then you would have license to reinterpret the story in some other way. I would have gone earlier, by the way. Well, maybe we'll have time to talk about this also. I would have said the Bereshit story, right? I mean, if we have evidence that the world is 15 plus billion years old, and the creation story, if you took the creation story at the simplest literal level and said it was 6 days and then Adam was there and then it's been less than 6,000 years since then. If we said that, you got a big problem on your hands if you want to believe in carbon dating and if you want to dig and find, woolly mammoths and people who are 10,000 years old all over the place, you want to find all that. So you have a big problem unless you have some other way around it. So to me, that's the most obvious way to apply this Rav Sadia Gaon. Question is, did anybody else agree with Rav Sadia Gaon about this? That this was okay? So, take a look at the Rambam. The Rambam in the Mor Nevuchim says, this is basic, by the way, this is fundamental. We do not reject the eternity of the universe because certain passages in Scripture confirm the creation. For such passages are not more numerous than those in which God is represented as a corporeal being, nor is it impossible or difficult to find them for them a suitable interpretation. Set the scene over here. The Rambam is dealing with the question of how old the universe is. And he's not dealing with whether it's 15 billion years old or 6,000 years old. He's dealing with whether it's 6,000 years old or eternal. Whether it's always been around, whether there was ever a time there was no universe, and what it means that God created the universe, it could be that he created it, yesh me yesh, for example. And there were two competing theories that said it was eternal. One of them was Plato's and one of them was Aristotle's. And he's going to reject them both, but for different reasons. Okay? So he says, for example, Plato's argument is just that the world is eternal, but God involves himself in the world. Now, we don't believe that as Jews, because we believe Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim et ha-aretz means that the world was created yesh me'ayin, something from nothing. But what if it was something from something? So the Rambam says, the truth is, I would have no problem with that. And in fact, if I thought it was true, I would read it into the Torah. And you know what? It would be a lot easier to read that into the Torah than what I usually read out of the Torah, which is God's corporeality. Right? The Rambam is the one who really, really, I think, historically speaking, the one who really, really got on the map the idea that God has no body. Just speaking historically, he's the one who really put that on the map. And yet, when you look in the Torah, left and right, he's got a hand, he's got a leg, he's angry, he's sad, he's happy, right? God has all kinds of human features. And the Rambam admits, that's what I love, he admits, I have a hard time with this stuff. It's hard to reinterpret it. And he says, it would be easier for me to accept yesh miyesh than it is for me to argue that God has no body. So why don't I do that? So he says, we might have explained them in the same manner as we did in respect to the incorporeality of God. We should perhaps have had an easier task in showing that the scriptural passages referred to are in harmony with the theory of the eternity of the universe, if we accepted the latter, than we had in explaining the anthropomorphisms in the Bible when we rejected the idea that God is corporeal. For two reasons, however, we have not done so, and have not accepted the eternity of the universe. First, the incorporeality of God has been demonstrated by proof. Those passages in the Bible which in their literal sense contain statements that can be refuted by proof must and can be interpreted otherwise. In his opinion, God is no body is something that he has proven.
What's the proof?
You have to leave the Morne Vuchim for that. But in his opinion, he has proven it, and therefore, because he has proven it, that gives him the right to reinterpret any pasuk in the Torah that mentions God's body to be non-literal. Very similar to Rav Saadia Gaon. Because reason compels him to do so, it's exactly the same as the fire example Rav Saadia Gaon gave. Because reason gives him the right to do so, he can reinterpret it. But the eternity of the universe has not been proved. A mere argument in favor of a certain theory is not sufficient reason for rejecting. So he says, but the flip side of that is that the eternity of the universe, Plato may have said it, but I'm not so convinced. I'm not convinced that it's correct. And since the simplest meaning of the Torah is that the world had a beginning, I don't feel the need to reinterpret the Torah, and therefore I will not. Even though I could, if I was convinced of the truth of Plato, if he was proven, then I would reinterpret the Torah. But I'm not, so I won't. So the flip side of the right to reinterpret when reason compels you to do it is the hesitance to reinterpret when reason does not compel you to do so. If the Torah says something happened, you have no reason to think that it didn't happen, then it happened. That's the argument.
See that sentence again?
If the Torah says something happened, and you have no reason to think, no strong reason to think that it didn't happen, then you should believe that it happened. But if the Torah says something happened and you have strong reason to believe that it did not happen, then
proof.
Then you should reinterpret the Torah in an appropriate way. Secondly, our belief in the corporeality of God is not contrary to any of the fundamental principles of our religion. It is not contrary to the words of any prophet. Only ignorant people believe that it is contrary to the teaching of Scripture. But we have shown that this is not the case. On the contrary, Scripture teaches the incorporeality of God. So he believes that the Nevi'im and the Chachamim argued that that the world did have a beginning. And therefore, that's another reason to not interpret the Torah that way. Now, this is interesting, because now he's saying that if something is a... It sounds like he's saying, if you have only the second reason, that if something is a fundamental principle, it sounds like he's saying that the Torah can't be reinterpreted even if there is a proof that way. Now, it sounds like he's saying, according to the second reason, that if something is sufficiently core and fundamental to our belief as Jews, how you determine that is a separate question, then you should believe the Torah even if it flies in the face of reason. So, for example, Aristotle's version of the eternity of the universe is that the world is eternal and unchanging. And always has been, we've talked about this, that God is more like the sun than he is like a willful being, in that the sun emanates light and cannot choose to not emanate light. In other words, if in Aristotle's viewpoint, God and nature are basically one. It just, God emanates the world, and that's why we all exist. He didn't choose to bring us into the world. He can't affect the world because he doesn't choose anything. He just is, and that's why the world is. The Rambam says that contradicts fundamental tenets of Judaism, and therefore, even if Aristotle had convinced me that he was correct, I still would reject it in favor of the Torah. What? Who believed that?
Rambam.
No. You've told me that before. He doesn't.
No. God and nature are one, and everything.
No, that's what Aristotle believed, and the Rambam writes that he rejects that, even if it was proven, he would reject it.
Isn't he just covering his own back? I mean, to say that you can reinterpret things because you don't see logic against science or whatever is a very dangerous thing. It doesn't seem logical that the world was created in 6 days. Therefore, I don't believe that man was created on the sixth. I believe he was created on the seventh. I mean, you can reinterpret anything. The guidelines become blurry,
but maybe that's okay. It depends. We'd have to evaluate on a case-by-case basis. By the way, I thought that I didn't put it, but it actually is on the sheet. The next paragraph, he writes his rejection of Aristotle. If we were to accept the eternity of the universe as taught by Aristotle, that everything in the universe is a result of fixed laws, that nature does not change, and that there is nothing supernatural, we should necessarily be in opposition to the foundation of our religion. We should disbelieve all miracles and signs, and certainly reject all hopes and fears derived from Scripture, unless the miracles are also explained figuratively. The allegorists among the Malmudians have done this, right? The Muslims. The Rambam lived in many Muslims' lands, and there were like four or five different schools of Muslims that he was very familiar with. And he argues with them throughout the guide. And have thereby arrived at absurd conclusions. If, however, we accepted the eternity of the universe in accordance with the second of the choice of theories which we have expounded above, and assumed with Plato, right? This is where I point out the difference between Aristotle and Plato. He says, the underlined part, the scriptural text might have been explained accordingly, and many expressions that might have been found in the Bible and in other writings that would confirm and support this theory. But there's no necessity for this expedient, so as long as the theory has not been proved. In other words, Aristotle I would never accept, even if I were convinced that he was philosophically accurate, because it would contradict the very foundations of the Torah. And therefore, I would not reinterpret anything for Aristotle. However, for Plato, since it doesn't contradict fundamental core principles of the Torah, I would accept it and I would reinterpret the Torah. But I don't have to, so I won't. That's the Rambam. If you go back to the 6 days of creation, right? So if the Rambam were sufficiently convinced that science says it wasn't 6 days, wasn't actual 6 days, so then he would say, okay, so 6 days means something else. And we'll see.
Maybe a day isn't 24 hours.
Yeah, maybe that, or maybe, the story is not even talking about the physical creation of the universe. Maybe it's not describing the cosmological creation of reality. Maybe it's describing something spiritual or describing something moral. Maybe.
And if science rejects the idea of God, that's a 101 fundamental.
So obviously the Rambam would say that's right. I'm not gonna be able to reinterpret the Torah to say that there's no God. But of course science is not in that business. Science is not in the business of deciding whether or not there's a God. Scientists sometimes think that it is, right? Science is in the business of describing the world as we see it and as we can measure it. Anything that cannot be measured, it cannot be seen, is not, science doesn't get to say anything about it. Even if a scientist comes along and say evolution is true and the The world is 15, 16, 17 billion years old, and we can explain every single facet of nature. It still doesn't disprove God. That's a failure in logic to say that it does. You can't make that scientific leap. It doesn't do that. Anyways, that's a separate discussion. Now we get to some more surprising source. You have the Rashba. The Rashba was in the school of the Ramban, and not necessarily one who I would consider to be the biggest fan of philosophy and science. He wasn't really, wouldn't consider him one of the rationalist Rishonim. He was, not to say he wasn't rational, but he actually was somewhat involved in the Maimonidean controversies. If you remember, after the Rambam's books came out, after he died, a lot of them were burned. There was a book burning of all the Maimonidean books. And there was big, big fights back and forth in Spain about the Rambam. The Rashba was one of the moderators. He was kind of on the let's not burn the books side. That doesn't necessarily mean that he held of everything that the Rambam wrote, but he was trying to tamp things down in favor of the Rambam. Now he is answering, this is actually from Mishaelis and Chupas. So he's answering a question here. He says, "Shaltani al inyan masha babe pirushi hagadot shepirashti." So you asked me about how I explain the Agadata in the Gemara. That's technically what he's talking about here. He says, "I said ledat rabotenu zal yesh lolam ketzev. I said that the world has a beginning and an end." Va'alabli b'chastira zemi masha katava Rambam u'begashta araya al divrei zulato. And you think that there's a contradiction with what it says in the Rambam. So he says, "Da." He says, I'll be honest with you. If we were looking at things, if we were looking at the world from a scientific perspective alone, from a perspective of chakira, of just investigation, of analysis, I would also say to you that the world has no beginning and no end. Because there's no evidence that the world has a beginning and an end. This is before the Big Bang. Okay, this is the Rashba is living in the 1300s, 1200s. From their perspective, the world looked like it was eternal. There's no reason to think there was a beginning or an end. Fishena chakira luchuha ela min hamurgashu min hagateva. Because science chakira only looks at nature and what it can see. We see that the planets move and they don't. There's no change in them, and they probably have always been moving. Anybody who says that it has a beginning, why are they saying that? They're saying that because they have a mesorah from the rabbis and from the scripture. Says, and the fact is that if you have a Kabbalah, that does defeat science.
Kabbalah defeats science.
Kabbalah or Nevuah defeats science. Why? Because it's a more direct access to knowledge. You have direct access to God's knowledge. That should defeat science. Now, what does he mean by science over here? What he's talking about...
Observable.
Is, right, but here what he's talking about is the beginning of the universe. So science's claim, in the 1200s about the universe being eternal is more philosophical than it is scientific, right? We know what science was like back then. It was, four elements and that kind of thing. That was called science. We don't consider that science. We consider it metaphysics. We consider it philosophy. We don't consider that science. If you're talking about, gravity... Right, and what we know about gravity. So I'm not sure that's what the Rashba is talking about. Although we will see, he's going to talk about something scientific in a second. It's pretty cool, actually. Here we go. He says the truth is, I'm not even sure why scientists are so sure about everything they say. Talking about the people in his time, because the fact is that they know as well as I do that a lot of the things that they're looking at have properties that they can't explain, that they have no explanation for. Skulot lo nudu lam sibatam. For example, all right, I'm going to read the example. You're going to tell me what he's talking about. Kemishichata even ashoevet et habarzel bli sheyedabek guf leguf v'acharken yishotet habarzel achar makom hazdan hakavua b'shamayim v'yifnei lav ulufanav yanuach.
Magnificent.
Magnets.
Yes.
It says, how is it that you have a piece of metal and you put another piece of metal near it, and all of a sudden they get connected to each other, and then you put another piece and they repel each other? Hey, nobody can explain this. Nobody can explain this. Is there anything more supernatural than this? That one object can move another object without touching it and without anything else? And it will turn around and attach itself? It's crazy. How does this work? Scientists have no idea. And I'm sure that at the time they had no idea. To be honest, we also have no idea. We can measure it. We understand how it works. We can guess what's going to happen. But in terms of the why, we don't get it. Right? I mean, that's still... We don't... Of course, by the same token, I don't know why the table moves when I push it. But... So that's... You know, we're not living in the 1200s anymore. But his point is well taken. That for them, that was inexplicable. So we have our own things that are inexplicable. And he says, "Be'emet im supar zel Aristo, haya machzivo b'li safek lulei shenitparsem ha'inyan pirsum rav." If you were to tell Aristotle about this, he would get very upset. I don't know. Did they have magnets in Aristotle's time? I don't know. V'achar sheitkayem etzlo ha'inyan, u'chozel levakesh min ha'tanot u'mitachakem aleihem. Okay, fine. V'da. This is the key line. It says, when somebody who is a chacham in Torah sees the words of the philosophers, and he is impressed with them, and he gets to the psukim that contradict the words of the scientists and the philosophers, pereshotam beinyan sheyeh neot lachakira filosofit u'misim inyan ha'mikraot mashal. He has the right to interpret the words of the psukim according to the science, or, I don't know, it sounds like, he can just say that it is a metaphor, that it's non-literal. No, actually, this is what he means, yeah. He means the psukim are non-literal, so that they don't reject the science.
He's reserving this right only to the Chachmei Torah Tenu.
Right, saying, but that's because of Andrew's problem.
He's not saying I have the right to do it.
Well, I think he thinks he has the right.
Chachmei Torah.
Saying, yeah, he's the Rashba. I think this is Andrew's problem. Andrew says, well, where are the lines? So the answer is, the lines are somebody who's an expert in Torah can properly apply these rules. That would be the argument. Aval.
Okay,
interesting. So he says, when you get to Chochmei Yisrael, what does he mean by this? Then you have to explain it according to the simple meaning and not like the philosophy. When you get to the things that are beliefs of Jews, then you don't explain them otherwise. For example, he gives an example. Kinyan Tchiyat HaMeitim. This is the response to your question. He says, look, you get to the Pesukim in Yechezkel, they talk about Yechezkel reanimating dry bones. To be honest, if I felt I had to, I could look at those Pesukim and I could interpret them allegorically. I would have no problem with that. No problem, right? However, the fact is, it's a fundamental core belief of Judaism in Tchiyat HaMeitim. And therefore, I don't need to do that, and I shouldn't do that, and I should say it happened literally the way it happened. So those are the boundaries. It's similar to the Rambam.
It is not a fundamental belief that Yechezkel had the power of Tchiyat HaMeitim.
It's not. But I think his point is that the scientists say that Tchiyat HaMeitim can't happen. That, we have to reject. Once we're rejecting it, there's no reason not to interpret Yechezkel the way it says it.
Sounds like a little bit of a stretch to say.
Why?
Just because we accept the possibility or the...
Not the possibility, that it will happen.
We accept that there will be Tchiyat HaMeitim.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean that one individual has the power of Tchiyat HaMeitim.
But there's no reason to...
It doesn't follow necessarily that A is followed by B.
It doesn't follow necessarily, but if we're going according to the rules, if there's no reason to reinterpret something, then we shouldn't. So here, there's no reason to reinterpret it because we believe that it could happen.
Can we just get back to Rav Sadia at the beginning and apply his second point
to the issue of tikkun.
Reason?
Yeah. So
again, I don't know why the reason one is the.
I think it would be fair to say that it's unreasonable to suggest that bones can be turned into life, that can make them sort of spawn life again.
The Gemara Sanhedrin. The Gemara Sanhedrin has an argument between, if I remember correctly, I think it's Cleopatra and one of the Chachamim. I think it's Cleopatra. I think so. I don't remember exactly. And she says, how is this possible? And he says, well, have you ever taken a seed and put it in the ground? And then when it sprouts, it all of a sudden looks like a tree. So why can't God put a person's body in the ground? And then when it comes out, it's a full body.
I'm not trying to be difficult. I'm just trying to understand his point, because it's all, you can always get out of Rav Sajid on the second point by saying you can just say it's a miracle. You can always say that.
Correct.
But I thought what he was saying is he was going further than that and saying, if I don't think it's reasonable, I'm happy to reinterpret that passage. I thought that's what he was saying, but it doesn't.
Because
Tikkun Meitim, I think it's fair to say that concept of someone buried in the ground coming up and being born again, that's an unreasonable thing. I think it's
unnatural, but it's not unreasonable.
I
read an article about that particular thing about Tikkun Meitim. If you even look at science today, you could take some DNA from a bone, grow it in a petri dish,
stem cells,
and bring it up again, right?
So whole body.
Maybe, who knows, in 100 years I'll probably be able to do that, right? But the fact that it's now imaginable that you could get to that point, that some of these things start becoming, well, maybe we couldn't interpret it now, but in the future we could.
Let's say 100 years ago, when stem cell technology wasn't around, if we can agree that would be an example of an unreasonable thing.
I wouldn't agree. I wouldn't agree, because there's a big difference between unnatural and illogical, right? If you talk about human beings being able to fly, no, that's not a good example, actually. Yeah, human beings being able to fly unaided, right? Is that unnatural or illogical?
Could happen in the future. I don't know. Anything can happen in the future. We don't know. Well, technology is changing. So
I think it's unnatural. It's not illogical.
Rav Sajid,
but
he's very explicit. His example that he says, which is illogical, is an example of comparing God to fire, which doesn't compute with our underlying tenets of faith, which God, it has no limits.
So that's the thing. Is he talking about our understanding?
That's
of
what
faith?
He said.
Yes.
Is about it? Our understanding of the natural world.
He isn't
our
talking about
logic. Our understanding of the natural world is that once people die, they don't come up again.
But that isn't his example.
Save for a miracle that might happen by God in the future.
I think the miracle is a significant part of that. I mean, God can do anything. But when we talk about God being described, can we think of another example besides God and fire?
I mean,
without God.
God has. No, but.
Fine, nothing with God.
That is his example. His example is
100%.
Something which disagrees with our basic of faith. It isn't talking about something which isn't.
No, it disagrees with our basic of logic.
No, logic extends as in logically because of.
Yes, because.
Something which we believe because of part of our faith. It isn't something which is. It's not something which is necessarily illogical.
No,
in,
I think it is. Because for them, by the
okay,
way,
fine,
reason and faith were
okay,
very.
For that's the point. But man not being able to fly isn't illogical.
Well,
it's just unreasonable. Fine. As in, it isn't something which I can imagine.
No, I'm not
that
stating,
isn't illogical.
I'm asking. What I'm really doing is I'm asking if Rav Sajid God means that we can take something like splitting the Red Sea,
right.
which seems to be something which doesn't normally doesn't
right.
happen, and that
right.
would seem unreasonable to suggest that happened. Unless you say it was a miracle.
So, exactly.
I'm asking, would Rav Sajid God take the miracle card and use it? Or would he be able to say, the splitting of the sea, I'm reinterpreting that because it doesn't work with me in a reasonable way.
So let me answer it this way. Maybe this will help. You know, if the text had implied that the sea split itself without any help from God, then he'd probably jump in and say, you know, it didn't happen this way. It's probably a metaphor. But the moment the text says God did this or God had involvement in this, it's no longer unreasonable at all. Like, God's doing it, so that's the explanation. You know, if I were to tell you that a rock picked itself up and threw itself across the room, you'd say that's ridiculous. But if I said, Yoel picked up a rock and threw it across the room, then you'd say, okay, that makes sense. I understand that. Yoel's able to pick up a rock and throw it across the room. So God can split the sea. God can cause tchilat hamitim. God can cause a bush to burn and not be destroyed.
Although there's no empirical evidence of that. It's true.
There's no empirical evidence that God can do these things?
Yeah.
But so what?
Yeah, when you like...
No, there is, because he did.
Right, but there's no, it's not like I look around in the world as I walk past and like God's doing things that I like, so I observe them. So.
Right, but they don't reject, they don't go against your logic that he can't do these things. I can easily imagine God doing these things.
Right,
it's like hard for me to imagine. It's hard for you to imagine a rock, according to the laws of nature as we know them, picking itself up and throwing itself across the room. That I don't want to say it's illogical, but it's pretty close. It's pretty close.
I just think that Rav Sadugan could have been saying something that's like game changing. He could have said, for instance, the first plague, water turned to blood. We know it doesn't happen, and therefore
that's very simple. You just look into his commentary. He doesn't say that. You can look at his commentary and Chumash. He doesn't do that.
He's saying that there could be miracles.
No, of course, yeah.
Because you take it so far as basically you also get rid of God, because God is by definition, by your definition,
I'm
using God.
No, here, by the way,
fine. I'm saying, but how far could you take it?
By the way, we have it in the Rashba. In the next underlined part that I have over here, he says, "V'chein nitamet etzleinu shehashem itbarach yachol lishanot et hatva'im kirtano lasim ma'amakei yam derech lavor l'chasot pnei adamah mayim." Meaning, we knew he was going to say this, but he says it. He says, obviously, anything is possible by hand of God. So anytime God does something in the Torah, there's no question of how did he do that. This is the Rashba. This is the Rashba that we're reading. You have to believe it. It says, the atone that's talking, the donkey that's talking to Bilam, right? So the Rashba will just say, okay, I mean, fine. God made the donkey talk. The Rambam doesn't think so. But. So that's, I don't know what he does say about that, but I don't think he would have necessarily a problem with that, because you could always just say that God did that. The Rambam doesn't say that, right? The Rambam says that it was a dream, but I think he just happens to say that. I think the Rambam says it was a dream because he doesn't think it's the kind of thing that God would do, make an animal talk. I think that's why he says that. But and I don't think he doesn't really believe that a malach would reveal himself to Bil'am. But in theory, I don't see why anybody would have a problem with that.
What, a donkey talking?
No, it's a separate creation. Not
saying God made a donkey talk.
Donkey talking.
Okay.
Right? It was one of the...
Yeah.
It's a separate creation.
Yeah.
It's difficult to work out what is the...
What's the line?
What's the line? Because you say on the one hand, creation is pretty clear that it didn't happen. I mean, it's difficult to really believe it. Happened in 6 days, blah blah blah, especially with all the scientific evidence that we have today.
Right.
So if we're already saying that science disproves these things, then at what point do you say, for example, the miracles, of which miracles do we...
Good, so, no, but we have an answer to that. The answer is you don't unless you have to. That's the answer so far. That's Osad Yugon's answer, that's the Rambam's answer so far. That's the Rashba's. What do you mean you never have to? No, it's not true. What do you mean? So what are you going to say? I'm just curious. So what are you going to say about creation? Let's say you said the world is 50
days.
It really happened in 6 days.
It was a miracle.
What do you mean it was a miracle? What was miraculous about
it?
Hashem made it
in 6 days.
But what it looks like is 15 billion years old. But it looks like it's 15 plus.
Yeah, but he made it look like that.
He made it look like this. That's the Rebbe, right? That's Lubavitcher Rebbe. That's what he wrote. Of course, but I wanted to hear what you guys wanted to say. That's what Rabbi Lubavitch, that's exactly what he says. He says he put the dinosaur fossils in the earth. He made the whole universe look this old. Why don't we want to say that?
He separates science and religion.
Who? Lubavitch Rabbi? No, there he makes them fit. Because he says... No, I think he... Look, you may not like his answer, but his answer makes science reconcile itself with religion, because he's saying that God made the earth look old, and that's why science says it looks old. It's perfect. In other words, from a science and religion perspective, it's a perfect reconciliation. Anytime you have a contradiction, you just say, God made it look that way. It's perfect. We're just deeply uncomfortable with it, because it's kind of, to me, it's kind of tricky. Why would... I mean, especially the dinosaurs thing. Like, that seems unnecessary.
We need dinosaur blood for oil.
Yeah, I couldn't have come up with a different way of doing that.
Well, why not? It's a perfect way to explain oil.
No, it's everything.
Yeah.
Okay, now explain the quarks that are a billion light years away. What do we need those for?
Because one day I needed to see a little bit of light, and that gave me light. I don't know.
Yeah, so
we don't know.
Okay, so the problem, it's actually, the Lubavitch Rebbe didn't make it up himself. I think a Christian philosopher named Gauss came up with it first. But that is his argument. He writes that in one of his letters. That's his argument. I don't think it's a very popular argument for most modern Orthodox people.
Makes the pursuit of truth irrelevant because it's
Yeah, and it kind of I don't know, it makes me uncomfortable. Like, why would God trick us like that?
Why not?
What do you mean, why not?
He made a tree with a as in the first tree he made, or had, you know, only had one ring because it's brand new. No, it had he made a big oak tree, so it had had 100 rings. I'm like, even though it was a second old, but why is this so hard?
What's this about a tree?
A tree has a ring every year.
Right.
So yes, he's right.
The first tree that God made, he made a big, grosser tree. He made only had one ring. Of course not. Why would?
Okay, I see.
A rock is you know, it looks like it's being compressed by billions of years. That's what a rock is. A world is apparently this. I mean, it isn't.
It's a little more complicated than that. That's not how they know. They don't. That's not the way they know that how old the world is by looking at rocks.
It's
carbon dating. It's using radiation.
But that's what a bone is. If you carbon dated Otmar Rishon when he was created, it would have shown that he was 1 second old. Why would you think that?
That's the implication of the Torah.
No, but when he created a complete man.
Yeah.
That tree, look, my tree example is
you're saying just like he made a man that was complete, who looked like, and
it created a tree.
So
I created a
universe that was 15 billion years old.
That's not a...
So, you know, technically speaking, I don't have a counter argument. It just makes me feel deeply uncomfortable. I don't like it. That's
especially
all.
Especially if all the rabbis are saying that we don't necessarily need to take the words of the Torah literally, especially when science comes.
No, but I don't see that's what he's saying. Is that you only need to interpret things differently if the science contradicts. The science doesn't.
No, but it does. The science doesn't contradict your reading of the Torah. That God did this and he made it look old on purpose. The Torah never says that God did this and made it look old.
He said he created man. He didn't create a man. If you carbon dated any man, wouldn't be, if you carbon dated him, it wouldn't be like he only existed right from that second. If you carbon dated it, the carbon deterioration, whatever it is, it would have shown that he was a 50-year-old man. Not
so
that he
what?
Was an infant.
But what's your point?
So what exactly about these things that are in conflict? What would require me
when
to
reinterpret? When you find a fossil that's 90,000 years old, you believe that God planted that in the world, being 90,000 years old, 6,000 years ago.
What do you mean, why not?
Other people find that uncomfortable.
I don't see it.
Forget about the animal. Look, let's say the world, let's say the universe.
It's a strange behavior.
Wait a second.
It's the same thing as a tree.
The world is 6,000 years old, right?
Because a person is dated, but if science can show that this bone is 100,000 years old, 200,000 years old.
Right.
Well, if you cut down that tree on day one, that tree would have looked like it was 50 years old.
I don't know why you keep mentioning that.
Let me put it this way.
We have found fossils of animals that existed and no longer existed 10,000 years ago and didn't exist 9,000 years ago. In other words, there are bones of animals that predate
a butterfly. Flaps his wings in.
No, you're just spouting random things now. Now you're just spouting random things.
No, that's the way.
No. You find a woolly mammoth, right? Which nobody has ever seen, right? Because in the last 5,000 years, there have been no woolly mammoths, right? But you find him in layers that are 10,000 years old or 15,000 years old or more. You're saying that when God made everything and he made live animals, he also made dead animals and put them in the ground.
I also can't explain why certain rare sort of beetle exists in South America. But that doesn't prove or disprove anything.
Right, but we have to be reasonable.
I don't have to reinterpret.
So we have to be reasonable. We have to be reasonable about these things.
The Torah itself doesn't actually say that the creation occurred in 6 days. As we said, the sun wasn't created in the fourth day.
Maybe
the first 4 days couldn't have been 24 hours. We know that for a fact.
We know that on day two, for instance, it says that God separated the waters,
yes,
but it doesn't say when he created the waters.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so there's all sorts of things within the 6 days, which are quite obviously...
Good. So, Andrew, so that's actually what they call a concordist viewpoint, which is you're actually not reinterpreting the Torah. You are reinterpreting the Torah, but you're not making the whole thing metaphorical. Hey, let's make this clear. There's one thing to reinterpret the Torah and say, this is what the Torah meant, and now it reconciles with science. That's called concordism. You're making the Torah concord with science. It's another thing to say...
Well, I think on its own, the Torah doesn't talk about 24 hours.
What I mean to make it concord is when you were eight and you learned Sefer Bereishit, you weren't thinking to yourself, okay, what the Torah really means is that it's, you know, the first day was a billion years and the second day was 5 billion. That's not what you meant. You're reading the Torah and you're saying, this is what the Torah meant when it said it, and that's why it stemmed with science. That's one thing.
All he's doing is reinterpreting the definition of a day.
Yeah, yeah. Fine, that's fine. That's fine. But there's another option. But isn't there? There's another option. There's another option, which is just to say the whole story is not even talking about science. That the whole story is not even going with that. Right? There's the completely metaphorical way of reading it. And then there's the concordist way that you're reading it. And then there's the literalist way of reading it, which is what the Lubavitch Rebbe does and what Yoel wants to do, which is to say the Torah means exactly what it says. And those are three completely different readings, right? So let me just do the last one, and I think that's where we're going to start for the stop for the night. We're not even going to get to the flood or Bereishit, really. We're just going to do the last one, which is the Ramban. It's actually it's partially the flood. Hold on one second. Let me just read the Ramban. It's partially from this last week's parsha. That's why it's definitely worth doing. And this is very, you know, the Ramban was a bar plukta with the Rambam, but people think of him as this like totally a Kabbalist. Right, I think that's our viewpoint of the Ramban, is like, you know, completely Kabbalist, anti-rational. So take a look at this one. Talking about the Keshet, he's talking about the rainbow. Zot Ota Brit Hashani Noten. That's what the Torah says, that God showed Noach a rainbow, and he said, this is the sign of a covenant that I put in the cloud. And the Ramban has a way of understanding what that means. He says, Shaloya Keshet Banan Mimase Bereishit. There was no rainbow. It sounds like there was no rainbow in the cloud from the time of Bereishit. Vata bara Hashem chadasha la'asot keshet b'shamayim b'yomanan v'amru b'tam ha'ot hazeh. And it sounds like the Torah is saying that there was never a rainbow before this, and God created the phenomenon of a rainbow on that day, such that every time there's going to be a rain afterwards, there's going to be a rainbow, and God invented that on this day when he introduced it to Noach. And he explains the idea of the rainbow is like an upside down bow, etc., etc. But now jump to the underlined part. All right? This is really important stuff. V'anachnu al korchenu na'amin ledivrei ha'yuvanim shemilat ha'shemesh ba'avir halachi ha'keshet betolada. But we, however, must believe the words of the Greeks who discovered that the phenomenon of a rainbow can be explained by nature and by science, that it has to do with the heat of the sun in the air, in the wet air, that creates a keshet. Ki b'kli mayim lifnei ha-shemesh yireh kemara ha-keshet, because you can do the same thing with a cup of water. Kasher nistakel od b'lashon, he says, now let's look back in the Torah, he says. Because we said that that's not what the Torah is saying. The Torah says that God created it. But now he says, look back in the Torah. Navin ken ki amar et kashti natati ba'anan. Natati is lashon avar. V'lo amar ani notein ba'anan. Kasher amar zot otabrit asher ani notein. U'milat kashti moresh haita lo keshet chila. It already existed. So now he looks back at the pasuk and says, I changed my mind. Really, the pasuk says that the keshet was always there, and he's now explaining to Noach why he created the phenomenon to begin with. It was created initially, right? The keshet was also something that was done before Maaseh Bereishit. He invented the phenomenon of the keshet so that one day he could show it to Noach and introduce him to the idea that this is an indication that there will always be peace between God and man after the Mabul. So what has the Ramban done, though? He has allowed the interpretation of the Yevanim, you know, I guess a weak way of saying this is to teach him something. But another way to say it is to actually affect his interpretation of the Torah. It's true that in the end he may have come up with a better interpretation than he had at the beginning, but it wasn't his initial interpretation, and the only reason it seems that he went for this interpretation is because he learned the science and he was convinced that it was true, and therefore he had to go back and do something about it. The last thing that I put on here from this section, actually the Meiri, who does something very similar. The Meiri was very much from the school of the Rambam. And he also says different categories. Although, I will read this part, actually, because you'll look at one of these categories, very interesting. It says, number one, our Torah and holy books may be divided into three categories. First category consists of those texts which should be understood only according to their hidden meaning, not according to their apparent meaning. All the verses referring to the corporeality of God, as well as Agadot and stories of impossible occurrences that have no connection to miracles and wonders. I don't know what the line is there. I don't know how he knows something is an impossible story and how he knows when it's miracles and wonders. I don't know. You probably have to go story by story to figure it out. Should be understood after this manner of interpretation. The second category consists of those texts which should be understood only according to their apparent meaning. This category includes the intelligible commandments, which would be fitting for mankind to observe, like Lo Tirtzach. He says, even if they had not been commanded, like the prohibitions against murder, theft, and robbery, as well as honoring one's father and mother and the like, these have no inner meanings and make reference to nothing other than themselves. And here is the money line. This category also includes the story of creation and other miracles. Okay, fine. The third category is those whose texts whose apparent meaning is their principal intention, but which point to some hidden meaning that issues from the principal intention and is more exalted than it. The commandments in this category are to be fulfilled based upon their apparent meaning, but are to be understood based upon their hidden meaning. The hidden meaning will be the fruit of the command. Okay, we don't have to get into that, but basically saying that every mitzvah that you don't necessarily understand LP logic, so it has a hidden meaning, so you should, you know, do the apparent one, but realize that there is a hidden meaning. And we'll stop there for tonight, and next time we'll go on to more specific examples and see some of what the Mefarshim say and some of what the, let's say, non-believers say. Shkoyach, everybody.